Good evening and welcome. It's KBC Arts. I'm David Fleming. KBC Arts, a program dedicated to arts and entertainment in our region, as well as the people and places providing it. Coming up August 17th and 18th, it's the 20th annual Jazz in the Pines in Idlewild. On the last edition of KBC Arts, we heard from bassist Rob Thorson. He'll be appearing on a couple of the different stages. And for more information about the festival, including a complete lineup, simply go to idlewildjazz.com. In the meantime, on tonight's edition of KBC Arts, two more of the artists appearing this year. Flutist Tim Weisberg in the background right now. He, as I mentioned earlier, was in the world of jazz fusion before that term even came about. Duke Ellington had to ask him what it was called. First, though, we're going to be talking to vocalist Janice Mann. She's got several albums under her belt. She makes jewelry as well. We'll be hearing some of that. And also, she has a really nice relationship with Diane Shore. It's KBC Arts on 91.9 KBC Arts. It's 7 minutes past eight.
That old black magic has me in its spell. That old black magic that you weave so well. Those icy fingers up and down my spine. Same old witchcraft when your eyes meet mine. Same old tingle that I feel inside. Then that elevator starts its ride. And down and down I go, round and round I go, like a leaf that's caught in the tide. I should stay away, but what can I do? I hear your name and I'm aflame. A flame with such a burning desire that only your kiss can put out the fire. You're the lover I've been waiting for. You're the mate fate had me created for. Every time your lips meet mine, darling, down and down I go, round and round I go in a spin, loving the spin I'm in, loving that old black magic called love.
First of all, I really look forward to seeing you again at Idlewild. It was a really cool treat last year. I will admit, I didn't know your name before last year, but you know, I was just blown away, and we'll get into the reasons for that. But let's go to the beginning. You're actually from Brooklyn. You grew up on Long Island. I have to ask, how long before you stopped saying Long Island?
What makes you think that
Did you stop saying it? Well stated. You started off drawing inspiration from your mom, and she was talking about playing folks like Nat King Cole, Ella Fitzgerald, of course, Sarah Vaughan, but your mom herself a gifted singer.
My mom had a wonderful voice, but she was not a professional vocalist. Uh-huh. But she sang all the time. She loved jazz, mostly vocal jazz. That's what was playing in my household early on. But when you think about people like Nat King Cole, when you're listening to Nat King Cole, it's not just the vocals, it's a presence.
Yeah. That would really hook you in. So it was, I suppose, as much of a feel as it was wonderful vocal qualities that you were hearing.
Right, right. Well, I just love the music. And also, you know, I remember staying up late with my mom and my grandmother watching all of these old movies. This great music came out of all of these old classic movies. So I always joke around. I think that I got this passion from my mom when I was in the womb because my mom loved it so much that very early on, I just remember I started playing the piano by ear when I was three. It's just really a strong part of who I am, this music.
It was just always a part, even mm-hmm. before you could articulate it, mm-hmm. it seems.
Yeah.
You studied classical piano early on, also guitar, is that right?
Yeah. I'm self-taught.
Okay, on both piano and guitar.
And voice, on vocals. I taught myself.
Oh, okay.
I've been singing professionally for a very long time, but different styles. I used to play guitar and sing. I traveled around Europe, supported myself singing in little cafes when I was a teenager. And it was an amazing experience, as you can only imagine.
And this was one of those things of you just, I'm going to take my guitar and go off to Europe. It wasn't, okay, you had a manager setting up a tour for you.
Right. No. It was very acceptable to go traveling around Europe back then.
Uh-huh.
Back then? In the 70s.
Okay.
It was just easy and it was inexpensive to travel.
Wow.
And, you know, I taught myself how to play guitar and I loved, you know, Joni Mitchell.
Sure.
Bob Dylan and all that great music. So I have a lot of influences, a lot of R&B and a lot of, you know, I don't want to call it folk music. Cause
mm-hmm. It paints a certain picture. I mean,
yeah, yeah.
Now, and then you ended up making a move to L.A. And I guess, is this where your education then really, really began?
I would say up in Seattle, when we lived up in Seattle.
This is where you ended up with Roy Haynes, yes?
Yes. I'm a big Sarah Vaughan fanatic.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to do a tribute to Sarah Vaughan when I was living up in Seattle. Well, how that started was I wanted to do some charity work. I went, well, I might as well use my voice. And so I spoke to one of the DJs up there who I was friends with. And I said, has anyone done a tribute to Sarah Vaughan here in Seattle? And he goes, no, Janice, no one's had the balls to do it. And I'm like, what have I gotten myself into? Because to do a tribute to Sarah Vaughan,
Sassy
you
Sarah,
better do some work.
Yeah.
Because this woman had an incredible range, incredible flexibility. I mean, she had it all. Dave, I spent a year studying Sarah before I recorded this. I mean, it was nuts, you know, but it was the best thing I ever did for myself because when I recorded this CD, we did a live CD at Jazz Alley.
Uh-huh.
And I said, in the liner notes, I says, thank you for the lesson, Sassy, because it changed my life. And we raised a lot of money for the breast care center up there. And it was just the most incredible experience. Roy Haynes worked with Sarah Vaughan along with every other incredible monster through the years. So I went to go see him live at Jazz Alley and I went to say hi to him. I said, hey Roy, I'm Janice Mann. I just want to let you know I'm a big fan and also I know you worked with Sarah for a long time. And I just did a tribute to her here at Jazz Alley. And he goes, oh, why don't you come back and sit in with the band? Oh, my God. Once again, he says, I'd like you to do a ballad. I went over to talk to his pianist, and I decided I was going to do You Don't Know What Love Is.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes, okay, great. We know that one, you know. I get up on stage with them, and the venue is packed with all these major, serious jazz fanatics there to hear Roy Haynes. And they all kind of look at you like, what?
There's the new girl.
What's happening here? We paid good money for this show. And so there's a lot of pressure. So also, there are his musicians like Antonio Hart, you know. They're like giving you this look like, okay, chick, you better know what you're doing.
Yeah.
So I decided that the best thing for me to do would be to start a cappella. The pianist, Martin, he looked at me, he goes, you want to start a cappella? And he goes, well, where do you want us to come in? And I went, just watch. And I could see the look on Roy's face. So I did that, and they were like, this is a good thing. Roy gets from behind the drums and says, Janice, please do another song. And I said, no. I said, thank you so much, but this is your show. Thank you. So I walked off stage, and he goes, I haven't heard anyone like her in years. Don't worry, we'll get her up on the next set.
Sweet.
And he brought me back up to do another song.
Some of the other folks that you've ended up playing with beyond Roy Haynes, Diane Shore. Now talk about a powerhouse vocalist. And you stand in front of the Basie Orchestra, you've got my respect. But you have a long-time relationship with her as well. I mean, gosh, you're an admirer of hers anyway. But you've performed with her for quite some time, yeah?
Hey, Deets.
Yeah, Jenny?
Ever notice when the moon is out, you kind of start to feel a little tingly?
Yeah, I feel tingly and crazy, and God knows what I'm going to be doing next.
Well, we met up in Seattle. We still are best friends. She's a guest on one of my latest albums. And I have had the honor of singing with her for, I don't know, 16, 17 years.
Wow.
Yeah, I've performed with her at the Blue Note in New York, at Yoshi's in San Francisco, at Catalina's. And I learned so much from this woman. First of all, one of the big things I learned is how to be fearless.
Yeah?
Because when you get up on stage with Diane Schur, anything can happen and everything happens up there. Because she's a true improviser. So what happens when you get up on stage, it's like, oh, let's do this or let's do that. And you got to be on your toes because you do not know what's going to happen. And it's amazing. So we're already friends with her.
Okay.
So we've established that. So we go out to one of her shows because she's from the Northwest and she was living up there at the time.
Okay.
As I was living up there too. And so we go to Jazz Alley to hear her. And I'm just relaxed. I'm in the audience. And out of nowhere, I hear my name. And I was like, what is she doing? You know, what is she? So she calls me up on stage and she goes, let's do After Hours. It's not the blues tune. You probably
know. Not the
know.
Avery Parrish tune. Okay.
It's an obscure tune that Sarah Vaughan recorded. It's an incredibly haunting, beautiful song.
Okay.
But it's not an easy song. The band didn't know the song. This is the first time I'm on stage with Diane, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
She goes, let's do this song. And so I went, what are you doing? She goes, just do it. And I'm like, okay. She memorized the song off the album. She led the band. It was a ballad, so they could watch the changes, watch okay. her play the changes. This was like a miracle. And I'll tell you, she may be blind, but she looks right through you. I tell her, stop looking at me like that.
Now, oh, one of the cool things, too, by the way, and if you're listening to this right now, not only will Janice be on stage at the 20th annual Jazz in the Pines at Idlewild, coming up in just a couple of weeks as of when this airs, but Diane Shore will also be there. This is going to be, and it's an incredible lineup this year again.
But I will be singing with her.
Oh, you're going to be on with her,
I'm going to sit in with her. I'm going to be doing my own gig that she might sit in with me at,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to be singing with her on her gigs. And like I said, anything can happen.
That's one of the things that we were talking about last year, is actually a love for Diane and the vocals and that powerhouse kind of stuff. One of the other things that I think I spoke to you right away was, it's not so much interpolation, you're not just quoting other songs, but laying down Old Devil Moon on top of the vamp for Killer Joe, or that type of juxtapositioning.
Mm-hmm. Basically, everything that you are, all of your experience, all the listening that you've done through the years, it all gets programmed into who you are. It's all a big part of who you are. And then learning jazz and really opening up your ears and listening to horn players and piano players, all kinds of musicians and vocalists, you let it all go. When you learn a song, you know, you learn the melody and you instinctively know the chord changes, that's where the magic happens, because you're not even thinking about it. I've recorded Old Devil Moon once before. This is how this whole thing started with Diane Shore. It's like, I recorded it on one of my albums, and Diane was listening to it all the time.
Oh, okay.
And
okay.
What happened was, she says, you know, let's do Old Devil Moon. I know you do it in B-flat. I have never played it in this key before, but what the hell? This is Diane. And I'm like, what the hell? Bring it on, Diane. So, yes, on the arrangement on the first time I recorded it, is the Killer Joe vamp.
Okay,
and, you know, it's a pretty easy vamp as far as chord changes to improvise over, because it's very simple.
Sure.
So Diane starts playing, and we start scatting, and I taught Diane Yiddish words. Can you imagine the two of us in New York at the Blue Note scatting and her saying Yiddish? It's as crazy as it sounds.
It's a conversation and music from vocalist Janice Mann. Janice is part of a quite a lineup at this year's Jazz in the Pines. It's the 20th annual Jazz in the Pines in Idlewild. That'll be coming up August 17th and 18th. Later, a flutist Tim Weisberg, a wonderful, wonderful conversation that it was quite the challenge to bring it down to the time that I did fit it into this hour. But what that really means is that we'll have a more extended program with Tim later this year. But in the meantime, though, back to Janice Mann. Janice and Tim, both among the many performers at this year's Idlewild Jazz in the Pines, the 20th annual Jazz in the Pines. That's August 17th and 18th. For more information, a complete lineup, as well as directions and everything else you may need, simply go to idlewildjazz.com. In the meantime, though, back to Janice Mann. This is KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. We were talking about the vocalists and shaping their instrument. Okay, Some of the best saxophone players or trumpet players, like folks like Clark Terry or Lester Young, I mean, you know, going back, to play the best sax for maybe a ballad, they would want to know the words to the songs. They're not just playing the melody, okay? So they could actually shape some of their notes and with the phrasing as a vocalist would. Do you ever find yourself taking your voice and trying to shape it like a nice round sound like a trumpet or something thinner like a saxophone, shaping those sounds?
Every single day of my life. every single moment. Being an artist is a lifestyle. And it's not about being a celebrity. It's about being an artist, listening and opening up your ears. And I'm also a vocal coach, so I love, it's another passion of mine, is to work one-on-one and share what I've gone through and try to give back what it is that I learned how to do through the years. But the approach that I take is not about being a vocalist, it's about being an instrument. I take the approach that I'm an instrument just like a saxophone or a trumpet. And so it's not how many tunes you know, it's like mastering your instrument is the number one important thing. And learning how to get the breath control, the sound you want, the dynamics.
Yeah.
Getting all of the dynamics that you want from your instrument and finding out who you are. The neat thing about all of this is that all of this stuff gets programmed into your brain and your chops, but it all comes together, and that's when, in performance, that's when you let it all go, because you have to let it go to have an authentic, honest performance. When you trust that all of the work that you've done learning your craft kicks in. If you listen to some of these monster players that teach, that have written books, you'll hear the same dialogue going on and on and on about learn your instrument and then let it go, because that's when all the magic happens as far as improvisation goes.
Nice, okay.
Yeah.
One of your latest CDs, Blow Away,
yes.
One that we have right here. This one has Bill Conliff and Christoph Lüdi, bass player on that one, and then Roy McCurdy, we're talking about another drummer. This one actually had some wonderful airplay, radio, internet, and cable. Didn't it make it number 15 or so in Jazz Week? Now, this was in studio collaboration, so this was Bill Conliff and brought in some of his stuff, and you brought in some of yours.
Well, basically, just to go back to the album before that one with Bill Conliff for a second.
Mm-hmm. Please.
I did a very highly arranged album that we mentioned earlier that's a tribute to jazz drummers that was dedicated to Roy Haynes.
Oh, yes, the one I'm holding in my hand, as a matter of fact, yeah.
The way that I approached that particular project was with Tamir Hendelman, who is a remarkable pianist and composer, and he's part of Jeff Hamilton's trio, a great drummer, and he is such an excellent arranger. We did all these complex arrangements together for that particular project. It's absolutely gorgeous, and I love everything about it, but when I went to the next project with Bill Conliff, I wanted the complete opposite. I didn't want any arrangements. So that was what we did. We went into the studio, and I had an idea of what I wanted to do, but I kind of wanted it to be more like a live thing where it wasn't overly arranged. I wanted that in-the-moment excitement. And so that's what we did with Bill Conliff, who is a Grammy Award winner, composer, arranger, pianist, and Christoph Lüdi is a part of Jeff Hamilton's trio. And Roy McCurdy, who is a very close friend of mine, who is an incredible drummer. See, he's on three of my albums, Roy.
Right, I keep on seeing that name and making sure I'm picking up the right one. Going back to A Perfect Time, you've got Love Walked In and Cool, this, I suppose, from West Side Story.
Right, it started out, we were going to do Cool as just a improvised kind of drum voice duet.
Yeah.
But Tamir wrote this ridiculously great arrangement, so it turned into this. You'll hear it.
That's one of those songs that people know. They don't know it by title, but they know when people are walking in with that snapping thing.
Well, you haven't heard it done like this before.
I'm sure I can agree with that without having heard it yet, but it's going to be, I'm sure, staying in the CD player for the next couple of weeks.
Stay cool, Roy. Got a rocket in your pocket. Keep coolly cool, Roy. Don't get hot, because, man, you've got some hard times ahead.
take it slow, and daddy-o, you will lift it up and die in bed.
We were also talking about Let It Happen. You're not just sticking with the ballads. You've got My Foolish Heart, one of my all-time favorites.
But, you know, we do that as a double-time samba feel.
Oh, really? So that's
it's
really
not
ramped
that
up.
The beauty is picking material that speaks to you, that you love, because to me, it's all about the honesty. If you love it and you're putting it out there the way you hear it, then not only are you going to connect with the musicians, but your audience is going to get the real deal.
Yes.
Every project is, you know, it's like your baby. Every project I've done is exciting and wonderful, and that's how it should be.
Yeah.
This one in particular is extremely special to me because for my personal growth, I feel like I reached a level for myself. See, I get completely speechless when I talk about this because every artist strives. You constantly want to master your instrument and you want to get to a place where you can play effortlessly.
Mm-hmm.
And when I met Kenny Werner, who is... You know, I'll tell you something. I don't use this word lightly, but I feel that Kenny is a genius. Not only one of the nicest people I've ever met, but extremely talented. It's a remarkable collaboration because, once again, we went into the studio without any rehearsing. We didn't even discuss any of the tunes before we went into the studio. You know, I just did not want this to be an overproduced kind of a project. I wanted it to be more of a live kind of thing. So I had lead sheets on tunes. No arrangements, but just lead sheets in the key that I do them in. We just put our heads together and we started playing. Kenny would go, okay, I have an idea. We would share ideas of how we were going to do it, and then we would just do it. I just went, you know, what are some of the tunes that I have always loved? You know, you could play Chopsticks with Kenny Werner, and it is going to be a phenomenal experience. So I just picked tunes that I loved and went, here we go, for this incredible ride.
Fantastic. This is going to be one to watch for, I have to say, and it sounds really like I'm pushing the product. So, full disclosure, I'm not. I believe in it, though. It's Celestial Anomalies. When this airs, this will have just come out maybe 4 or 5 days ago, so this will be a fresh one. I would imagine you'll have copies of this back in distribution by the time the jazz at Idlewild goes on.
Yes.
Okay, cool. Let's talk about the 20th Annual Jazz in the Pines. A cool, cool setup.
What a great hang. Oh, my God, it's so amazing. This year, I'm going to sit in on the main stage with Diane, but I'm going to be in a venue called The Barn. I hear it's wonderful.
The Barn is...
It's an intimate indoor venue.
Yep.
And I've got Joe Bagg again, but he's going to play piano. And then Henry Franklin on bass.
Skipper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is going to be a lot of fun because this is my first time working with Skipper, and he's a phenomenal talent.
Have you ever seen his bass? He's got a cool lion's head carved into the top of that thing.
Yeah. And Clayton Cameron's going to join us again on drums.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, and Clayton is an amazing person. Always brings surprise guests to the table as well. If you go to Janice's website, again, it's simply janiceman.com. That's with two N's in man, so janiceman, M-A-N-N.com. You will find, other wonderful surprises. We've talked about Roy Haynes, Kenny Werner. Bruce Foreman is somebody else that she plays with on a fairly regular basis, a guitarist in this area. But you'll also possibly be able to get private lessons and jewelry design.
You know, since I was a kid, it was always music and visual art. When you're an artist and you're very much in touch with your feelings, you can go in so many different directions. Like Tony Bennett is an incredible visual, and Joni Mitchell is an incredible visual artist. I have done portrait art. My husband, who's a wonderful animator, he has collaborated with me on art for all of my CDs.
Mm-hmm.
So everything that you see, my husband and I have designed all of the art for the CDs. But when I was up in Seattle, and by the way, it rains all the time. It rains all. I don't know if I told you this, Dave, but it rains all the time. And I'll tell you.
What's the weather like in Seattle?
Have I told you?
What's it like? Tell me. Does it rain?
It rains. It rains all the time. But when it doesn't rain, it is spectacular. It is the most beautiful place, unbelievable place to live. Oh, my God. It's amazing. it's a love-hate thing with Seattle.
Sure, sure.
But the jewelry thing, it was very rainy one day, and I was feeling very gray, just like the weather. And my neighbor and friend says, come on over. You know, she did it for a hobby, you know, she started making jewelry. Come on over and I'll teach you how to make a necklace. And I went, okay. And she had some beads and stuff, and I wasn't really that excited about what she had, but she taught me how to make a necklace. And that was the end of it. I went to gem shows and bead stores and started teaching myself how to be a silversmith. Forget about it. She turns around. I started doing these like small jazz festivals where I would sing and I would have a booth with all of my jewelry, and she goes, come on. What? It rains all the time. And also, it is incredible balance to the music. For me, I love working with my hands. The thing I love about designing and making jewelry is that you can look, you could stare at it.
It's a tangible object.
Yeah, it's not just hanging on the wall somewhere. And I love when people come to my gigs and they're wearing my jewelry. Remember, you made this?
That's cool.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
Nice.
Oh, I do a thing called Jazz and Jewels, where I'll do a house concert and they can buy my jewelry. Yeah, it's very cool.
Oh, beautiful.
I've done art gallery concerts. They display my jewelry. Yeah, it's really, it's very cool. It's so cool. I can't even tell you. We'll talk. Oh, we'll have coffee. Listen, my parents who are now gone, they're up in heaven. They're looking down at me going, what? No grandkids? The guilt, it's a genetic disorder. You know, the guilt, it just doesn't go away. Why be happy when you can be miserable? But it comes out in my music. Thank God.
And there's a synergy right there. You can kill those two birds with one stone.
Well, I'm very impressed with you, Dave. You even got into the jewelry. I don't even know what to say. I'm verklempt right now. Talk amongst yourselves. I'll give you a topic. Rhode Island. It's neither a road nor an island. Discuss.
Okay, go. Okay, with that, and now I look at the clock again. If you go to our site again, janusmann.com, there's not only contact information divided up into a few sections for either booking, for shows, for private lessons, or maybe clinics, and then also for jewelry. And Janice is fun to hang with behind the scenes, and I know some of that came through on the microphone, but Janice, thanks a bunch. I shudder to think you can get away from here before the traffic really starts.
I am not going to mind at all, because this was such a nice experience.
Thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
Janice Mann, one of the performers at this year's Jazz in the Pines in Idlewild. That's the 20th annual Jazz in the Pines in Idlewild. For more information, simply it's idlewildjazz.com. For a complete lineup, directions to the place, it's really, really cool lineup this year. So be sure to check it out. Janice is one of the performers, one of this great lineup I mentioned. Also, Tim Weisberg, who is in the world of jazz flute and went back. Started off in the classical world, but soon drifted into jazz and rock, and soon those two things were combined. The story goes back, though, quite some ways. Let's just go back all the way. I read this, but I'd like to hear you say it. You ended up on flute, in essence, because of alphabetical reasons.
Yes, the accidental flutist. When I was going to school, we didn't have a music program in grammar school, and I had acquired an early taste to rock and roll probably in the fifth and sixth grade, much to the horror of my parents. I would turn the radio dial away from their stations occasionally when I got permission. And I became fascinated with drums. And so when I got to junior high school, drums and percussion were taught in the wind class.
The wind
class. That basically would mean all of the brass instruments and all of the woodwinds. So I enrolled in that class as an elective, and the great band director, Mr. Armour, who was a brilliant flute player, commenced to decide what we were going to want instruments to play. And he just decided from an orderly standpoint that maybe we just do it alphabetical order. And I didn't think at the time to say, why don't we start at the back of the alphabet and go forward. I was the last person in that class with W for the beginning of my last name. All that was left was flute and bassoon. No percussion, nothing else. And a bassoon, as everybody knows, to a seventh grader looks like a telephone pole. And sitting next to it was a flute and a flute case. I decided to go with flute, much to the excitement of some of my friends in the class, because everybody else who had selected flute was girls, and that was not a cool thing to do. And you're 12 years old if you were a guy. Not back then. It was, at least it was enough to get kidded by your friends. Mr. Armour noticed my disappointment that day that we got to pick our chosen instrument. He said, hey, you seem a little less than excited compared to the way when you came into the class. So talk to me about it. So I told him, I said, guy, I don't flute, I don't know, I wanted to play the drums. And he said, I will make you a deal. I will start to explore the possibility of getting some extra funds so that we can get another set of percussion instruments. If you will, try this for up to 4 weeks. I think I can do this if you just make a good effort. And so by the end of the fourth week, he says, well, what do you think? And I said, well, it's sort of interesting, and I was kind of on the fence. He said, you know, I'm thinking that maybe a private lesson or two might be advantageous for you. So he called my parents up, and my parents said, could you recommend somebody? He said, this is going to sound a little self-serving. He said, I teach flute, and I would very much like to give him some private lessons. He said, I can also recommend some other teachers in the area, and you could make some inquiries to find out. Well, what my parents found out was he had a waiting list of about 80. He was the premier teacher in the area. People would come from 50 and 60 miles away. Parents would drive them to lessons. Before we started, he said, now that you've been playing the flute for about 5 weeks and you're going to take your first private lesson, do you have any questions before we go forward? And I said, yes. Would you play your flute and play something for me? I want to hear what it could really sound like. So it's interesting, because instead of taking a highly technical, very fast piece that shows, you know, rapid tonguing and virtuoso stuff, sure, he ended up taking something that seems, on the face of it, very simple, from Afternoon of a Faun. And it's a very famous flute solo that does not have fast notes in it, but I was hypnotized. It was amazing. I had to open my eyes up while he was playing to see if it was real.
So many flute players may also pick up the sax, despite the fact that we're talking about reeds versus pure wind. Similar fingering. I know you never really did that. We talked about that, but did you ever pick up the piccolo or the other extreme, maybe the bass flute? Did you ever go that route?
Yes, absolutely. A lot of jazz players will come to the flute when their first instrument was saxophone, and the fingerings are similar to the flute. Yes, I play the bass flute, I play the alto flute, play the piccolo, and then there's a rare one, the E-flat flute. It's kind of a hybrid. The bass flute would be an octave lower in the flute, then the next instrument up would be alto flute in the key of G. And for the listeners, the bass flute's a much larger in diameter tube, but it has to be longer to get the lower pitches, so most of them curve back. They look like a piece of plumbing.
In a J
shape. You would always know if you were seeing somebody playing a bass flute. The alto flute looks like the traditional flute, but it's longer, and if you look, you go, God, the flute player's arms seem to be more extended off to the right to put his hands on it. Then the C flute would be the one that most people know when they think of flute. Yeah. And then this kind of novelty instrument, the E-flat flute, looks exactly like the flute, but it's a miniature. And a piccolo is about half the length of a C flute. That's why it's an octave higher.
Okay.
The tube is half the length, and it's quite petite. And at the high pitches that you play, you could hear it over a 200-piece marching band, or obviously on a symphony orchestra.
Okay. I'm David Fleming with you for KVCR. It's here at 91.9 KVCR. Back to this interview, this wonderful conversation with Tim Weisberg, and more music from him as well. We'll hear the beginnings of his introduction into the jazz world, in the world of flute. Coming up at 9 o'clock, it's an hour of On Point with Tom Ashbrook, and then it's the BBC. It's 8:41. You're with KBC Arts at 91.9. KBCR, also at kbcr.org. I want to throw basically, in essence, a few players at you in two different worlds. I want to know what you picked up from them. First, let's look at the world of, I'm going to group together Hubert Laws, Herbie Mann, and as far as an East Coast player, maybe Jeremy Steig. But then now in pop and rock, Ian Anderson from Jethro Tull. We've got the Moody Blues with Ray Thomas, Mel Collins, if you go with King Crimson. I'd kind of like to know what you picked up from these guys. And I know these are two different worlds, but both of these, in the jazz world, it's a soul and a funk infused thing than any of the mainstream or pop.
Exactly. The first jazz flute I ever heard was Herbie Mann.
Which one? Me too.
I think it was called Live at the Village Gate.
Oh yeah, yeah, there's three tracks on it.
The song that I heard was Coming Home, Baby.
Coming Home, Baby.
I think I heard on the radio this Coming Home, Baby, and I went to my classical lesson. I had gone out and bought the record, so
yeah.
We took a moment. She goes, "That's jazz." And
we don't
she
do
said,
that,
"Don't even ask. I haven't the slightest idea how to do that."
Oh my gosh, okay.
As I started to explore this, in addition to still consuming preponderantly in my listening time rock and roll music, I was also sampling jazz. And I didn't only listen to flute players. I fell in love with the funkier side of what people like Cannonball Adderley did.
Oh, sure.
Wes Montgomery,
yeah.
Mongo Santa Maria, Willie Bobo, and I'm leaving a ton of people out.
Oh, sure.
But they were doing Herbie Hancock with things like Watermelon Man.
Yeah.
Now, those are all incredible bebop players, yet they also had this side where they played this kind of funky R&B blues type thing, and that's what appealed to me, because for me the melodies were infectious. I'm not a person who likes a lot of dissonance,
mm-hmm.
although the jazz guys call that getting outside the chord and then coming back in. As I was learning from some of my friends, when I did something like that, they'd go, "Oh, cool." And I go, "No, that's not what I wanted to play. It's not melodic."
You could have bluffed them. Yeah, that's what I was aiming for.
Well, I tell them, I said, "Well, how do you know what the difference is?" And they went, "Well, we never thought of that."
Gotcha. You just do it three times, then it sounds like it's on purpose.
Exactly.
Yeah. You were soon, I think, playing with Paul Horn. People will find him in the New Age section, or possibly contemporary classical, depending on how hip your local music store may be. When you were working with Paul at this point, were you playing what you wanted to, or at this point was this a gig, a steady check you were being paid to play?
Once again, Tim's never going to answer. It's a good thing we're not on the witness stand. The judge would be going, "Answer the question," instead of telling a story.
I would rather get the stories.
You will. There's no way to... Well, of course there is. Click. Hello? Just went into a tunnel. So, I was in graduate school in psychology, not music, because I had no intentions of being a professional musician.
Right, you were thinking about employment.
Yeah, I
was. Employability.
When this happened, this was probably in the late 60s.
Okay.
And Paul was, by then, also one of the top studio doubling musicians.
Okay.
And then he discovered Transcendental Meditation. It's what took him to India, where he did the iconic and famous, basically takes a flute and he goes inside the Taj Mahal with these amazing acoustics and does some amazing improvisation, which had a strong effect on me, something that just kind of blew me away. So I met him, and about a year later, he called me up. And what I was doing in graduate school was fraternity parties and cocktail parties and bar mitzvahs. And I'd get to play one or two songs, and they'd say, okay, we're going to do Light My Fire, Tim. I'd be standing in the corner. So in all of that, I get a call from Paul Horn, and he says, look, I'm putting a group together to demonstrate different kinds of music. And they would play some classical music, some Brazilian music, and then they would do Light My Fire was the nod to rock and roll. There was a government program at the time that would subsidize educational programs, so there was some component to Paul giving a lecture, but it would be in a concert setting. And we did an album on a little label. I'd never been in a studio. I was terrified. Sounds like I get terrified a lot, right?
Yeah, so far, yeah.
But yet I continued to do it because I loved the feeling of that freedom of playing and improvising. And it was in the studio that I did my very first album 18 months later for A&M Records. Kind of surprising. And at the point I'm playing on this album for Paul, I still hadn't made up my mind that I was going to go be a musician. I was still just trying to finish my master's degree. I started my recording career at A&M Records. I don't know that I would have the career that I had. I was able to have free rein to do whatever was going on, and that's very, very unusual. And I was consuming, you know, just like anybody else on the car radio and buying people's records. And
sure.
I heard Dan Fogelberg and bought the album, and I liked it. And I bought his next one and his next one over each one of those years. And I saw him play a couple of times. Unbeknownst to me, he was doing the same thing. He was buying my albums and seeing me play in different places, but I didn't know he was there, and he didn't know I was there.
Oh, wow.
I believe it was 76, and I got a phone call from his management company calling up and inquiring if I was available to do a recording session for one of their artists. I didn't really do a lot of session work, and not because it was beneath me, but because I found it extremely difficult and painful to be trying to be in the studio on some music that didn't move me.
Right, okay.
Doesn't mean it couldn't move other people. So I said, you know, I think I'm really busy then. Who's the artist? And when they said Dan Fogelberg, I literally actually had to control myself and say, when's the date? I'll be there a day early so I'm not late. And how much do I have to pay you? That's how enthused I was. So I tried to control it, and I said, yes, I'm looking at the wrong month. I'm available.
There you go. Nice bluff.
So I show up at the record plant, and Dan gets up and greets me. Of course, he doesn't tell me he owns all my albums and to see me play live, and I don't tell him either.
Right.
And we talk about groups we like and all that kind of stuff. And then he says, well, I got this song. I'm wondering if you could, maybe kind of take a solo and blah, 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 like that. And Dan and I just really kind of hit it off. So we kind of stayed in touch. He lived in Colorado in a place called Netherlands.
Just a little bit west
of Boulder, Colorado, which means if you go west, you're going higher up the Rockies. And actually just down a dirt road from the studio that Chicago built up in the Rocky Mountains and did a lot of their albums,
yeah,
called Caribou. He suggested that I had to come up to the Netherlands, or I could meet him in Aspen. I had dabbled at fly fishing, and we both liked photography and bring a camera. Bottom line is we just sort of kind of palled around long distance. 76, I'm almost sure, I was up in Aspen and was up there, and they had this silly golf tournament, and I think there were people in the Eagles, and I mean, this was private, just people hanging out. I mean, four-wheeling and Jeeps and all that kind of stuff. You know, we got to be friends, and we talked music and, you know, on the road and the typical stuff artists would talk about. At some point, he gets the credit for it. He says, we ought to do an album together. And I went, wow, that sounds like fun to me. Just talked about it on and off. Then we kind of made plans, and his manager, Irving Azoff, sort of put the stuff together. And then at one point in 77, Dan said, well, Irving wants to talk to you. I talked to my business people, my attorney, and he goes, well, don't sign anything yet.
First bit of advice there.
And I was not that familiar with Irving Azoff. It's really funny because he said, well, Dan wants to do this album with you, the two of you. And I said, yeah, we've been talking about it. I think it'll really be fun. And he goes, no. He said, I don't want you to take any offense. And I know you're very talented and everything. He says, but you know, I don't know why. I mean, you know, you're just a flute player.
Oh, no.
He kind of caught it. He says, I mean, I know you're a great player and everything. And in my mind, I'm going, yeah, he probably never heard me before. But his job is his client that he represents wants to do this album with me. But he's telling me he doesn't think it's a very smart idea. But he said, if Danny wants to do it, then that's what we're going to do. And he said, the idea is you guys will be co-artists, 50-50, and co-producers. And after talking to Ms. Lange, you know, I'm a little goofy with my humor sometimes.
Yeah, I'm with you.
So, you know, Irving is the manager of the Eagles and Boss Gags and Jimmy Buffett and Steely Dan.
Oh, that's why
all
I
these
keep
huge
saying,
records
okay.
are going on. It's 1976, 77, right?
Yeah.
And he's got this goofy flute player sitting there. I said, okay, I hear you, artist, 50-50, because we're going to co-produce it and everything. I said, yeah. I said, okay, how about 70-30 me? And he goes, well, are you quitting? And then he used some expletives. I mean, he was like, kind of enraged. Are you crazy? And then I looked at him and I started laughing. He said, what are you laughing for? And I said, well, I said, my attorney said not to sign anything and that you're one of the most astute business guys in the cutthroat business that we're in. I said, I have difficulty buying a car, Irving. I said, so you kind of gave me a price and then I have to come back, right? Isn't that the way it works? He's kind of looking at me like, are you insane? I said, I mean, you don't take the first offer, do you? And he's like, he doesn't know what to do, right? And then I stopped. I could see that I don't know that he had the same kind of sense of humor I had, right?
Sounds
and
not.
I said, absolutely. That's exactly what Dan and I's intentions were. And that's exactly what it's going to be. It's a collaborative process. So, of course, that's the appropriate thing to do. And thank you for just putting it out there, because that's what Dan and I, we wanted to do the album together, and we were both going to freely contribute to it, you know, both as artists and producers. And that was part of the chemistry of it. You know, I didn't say that to him then, but afterward I tried to figure out why did this thing dwarf anything either of us had done until that time. And it let us kind of off the hook of carrying that trail we'd have for the rest of our lives, ever increasing as we did more albums of these other things that we've done, living up to it. Once again, we could be the guys in somebody else's band.
Yeah, absolutely.
It gave us that kind of free rein to do and feel, even with the constraints that we put on ourselves with nobody else, because there was no mandate from the record company about what to do. Now, one of the things, Dan, over us getting to be friends, was he did not want to sing on this album. He told me on numerous occasions, I just want to be a guitar player in the band and take solos and all that and play rhythm guitar. Well, now, he was an incredibly gifted guitar player, both as a rhythm player and as a soloist, and his way of layering guitars and things, acoustic, steel string, gut string, all that kind of stuff. It was brilliant. He said, I just don't want to be distracted by the responsibility of doing some vocals. And I jokingly said, oh, you mean the tortured singer-songwriter.
Oh, no.
And I was the guy with my sense of humor, you know, and he kind of looks at me, you know, he says, okay, all right, okay. I said, but I understand. But deep down inside me, I quickly formulated a plan to seduce him into singing a couple of things because I loved his voice. I mean, I owned all his albums.
Oh,
up
sure.
There.
Sure, yeah.
And I enjoyed the interplay of my flute and his voice and inspired me to do things differently. So once we started to get some really stunning stuff of his down, I then started to go, well, you know, there's some Holly's tunes that are really good and a couple other things. And he then said, oh, how about Tell Me to My Face? And I went, oh, God, I love that song. And then there was Since You Ask, was a Judy Collins song that he just did an amazing take on it. And as we got into those, I said, well, let's have an original. And that's how Power Gold, that's that was the last thing we did, the last thing we cut.
A lot of your music has a really strong funk fusion, a really cool groove thing going on. But now some is so gentle and easygoing, it ends up on the stations playing what they refer to as smooth jazz.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have my own thoughts on the subject. I see it as a format, not so much a genre. But some artists are even trying to produce this kinder, gentler, non-threatening jazz. I'd like to hear your thoughts on the term, because I know a lot of what ends up on there is really just the more ballad side of any artist who are throwing out the funk and fusion as well, but it's just their lighter stuff that gets played.
I'll tell you what, the whole evolution of that, at least for me, luckily in the 70s when I started, college radio would do it, and it was album-oriented radio, and I'd be getting played, and you know, right after a Rolling Stones song. But when the wave started in 87,
yeah,
up until about 90, it was actually called New Age and Contemporary Jazz. The word smooth jazz wasn't used. And it was pretty eclectic. I mean, they play me, they play Tom Scott, they play George Winston, they play ambient stuff and everything else. And then the format started to tighten up in the beginning of the 90s. And by 94, they had come out and done testing that stated that there were some instruments that were much more favored by the listeners. And consequently, they were not going to play certain instruments anymore, one of them being the flute.
Mm.
They also did the same with the vocalist. A surprising group of individuals were also banned from the stations, among them Al Jarreau. I know this for a fact because I was on an airliner going to Atlanta to that R&R convention, and the contingent from the Warner Brothers Jazz Department was on board. I didn't realize it, and the vice president came over and introduced herself to me and commended me for a interview I had done with the smooth jazz column writer in R&R. I was interviewed along with Joe Sample separately, and then our comments were combined in an interview.
Oh, cool.
That kind of caused a stir at R&R because we were talking about kind of the homogenization and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Very politically incorrect in a format where there's basically one consultant that basically consults all the stations. And she informed me that Al Jarreau, it was like a big deal within the industry. They weren't going to play him anymore.
Hmm.
I knew this guy, and I called him up, and I asked him, I said, you know, Herbert Laws plays different than I do, and Herbie Mann plays different, and Jeremy Steig plays different, and there's a whole cornucopia of some of these saxophone players that you play, as long as they play soprano sax, that also play flute. And to just ban an instrument, I think it takes away the variety, and it's going to make things kind of boring over a time period, and took longer than I thought, but that's kind of what happened.
If we're reacquainting the world with Tim Weisberg, name three or four that people ought to get acquainted with you, musically speaking, and get a good sample.
Definitely the Twin Sons album.
Okay.
And then some of my solo stuff. My first 13 albums on vinyl haven't been in release for decades, but that just has changed. They seem amenable to slowly roll out all of the other albums. So there's 7 on A&M, 2 on United Artists, where Chuck Lavelle played keyboard. We brought him out to play keyboard on both albums, and people might recognize that name more now as a keyboard player for the last 25 or 30 years with the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, that's really nice. Wow.
And then 3 on MCA.
Nice. Well, I really look forward to seeing you in Idlewild, and no matter what happens, I will be coming up. Look for a guy that, I maybe shouldn't say it this way, but looks like you circa 1973. So I'll be coming up and introducing myself.
And I'm looking forward to meeting you face to face.
Indeed, I will make sure that happens.
All right.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Tim Weisberg, a real treat to be able to speak to him. And a reminder, he is one of part of a great, great lineup again at this year's Jazz in the Pines, the 20th annual Jazz in the Pines in Idlewild. That's just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks to Janis Band, Tim Weisberg. Make sure to check them out at Idlewild through their CDs, their websites, or in person. They're in the area. Thanks also to Karen, who, among many other hats, I'm sure, keeps the Tim Weisberg official Facebook going. She might possibly be the one to have gotten Tim to finally give up his dial-up internet connection as well. Thanks to Regina Davis with the Idlewild Jazz Festival. Again, idlewildjazz.com for a complete lineup of this year's festival, August 17th and 18th. Here at KVCR, thanks to Jessica James, Shaylin Blaney, Anand Manuel, Program Manager Rick Dulock, and Station Manager Ken Cooch.
Thanks also to contributing members who make programming possible on KVCR. A reminder, you can now get podcasts of KVCR's, including tonight's, at our website, kvcr.org. Thanks also to Sean Longstreet, normally providing the music beds heard during KVC Arts. Tonight, though, the music came from the artists themselves. But thank you, Sean, anyway. News headlines from NPR coming up in just a few moments. Then we go into an hour of On Point. It's the BBC coming up at 10. This is 91.9 KVCR San Bernardino Riverside, where you learn something new every day. Streaming online at kvcr.org. We are a service of the San Bernardino Community College District. I'm David Fleming with you for KVCR. It's dedicated to arts and entertainment in our region, as well as the people and places providing it or creating it. Thanks again for listening. It's 9 o'clock. News headlines from NPR up next.